It's All Songs Considered. I'm Robin Hilton. We continue our look back at the past decade in music now with the year 2015. I'm here with NPR Music's Ann Powers.
Hello.
And Dawood Tyler Amin.
Hiya.
We're going to start the show off with what many people thought was the best album of 2015, Sufjan Stevens' Carrie and Lowell.
Spirit of my silence, I can hear you, but I'm afraid to be near you, and I don't know where to begin, and I don't know where to begin.
I've talked so much about this record, I kind of feel like there's not much more I need to say, except that I guess I just was thinking, you know, it really, to me, is one of the most vulnerable records of the entire past decade, mm-hmm. I think.
Mm. Maybe of the entire recorded history of music.
It's just so vulnerable and so heartbreaking, so honest and raw. It's all about Sufjan Stevens' mother, his memories of his mother, Carrie, and his stepfather, Lowell. She was schizophrenic. She was an alcoholic. She abandoned him when he was only a year old. He continued to see her over the summers until he was about 8, and then she disappeared completely from his life until much later on in his adult years. They reconnected. She had cancer. He was by her side, and he pours all that grief into this record. I think one of the things that works so well about this album is that when an artist emotes as much as Sufjan Stevens does on this record, it's so easy for it to become mawkish or overly sentimental, and he just pulls it off with such grace.
Mm. Absolutely. And what I think is remarkable is that he does so, but within this musical framework that is very precise, that he's been working to perfect for a very long time, this almost minimalist but electronic influenced, you know, singer-songwriter bedroom auteur pop sound that is just like a beautifully, it's like a Michelangelo sculpture or something with a beating heart.
He opens with this song, Death with Dignity, which is a song all about forgiveness. He says, I forgive you, mother, and I long to be near you. And then he looks back after he starts working his way backwards. But he starts from this point of view where he just loves her and forgives her. And even after everything he's been through, he has nothing but love.
It's interesting to try and trace the chronology of where he had been leading up to this record, because you get hints of these themes in the celebrated records from early in his career, from Michigan and from Illinois, I think. About, you know, songs like Romulus and Predatory Wasp with the Palisades, those like beautiful, like affecting songs, Casimir Pulaski Day. And then, like, there was a long while where it seemed like he was in that phase where he knew that, like, people would keep showing up to his stuff, but everybody felt like it was getting, by quarter turns, a little weirder every time. Mm-hmm. You know, the BQE project, the Age of Odds, is that how you say it?
ADZ Odds.
And it was really, there was like a whiplash effect, like having him snap all the way back to that entry point with this record. And even more so because he was stripping away the conceit of this, you know, 50 States project and just, you know, speaking in the first person for real.
Well, we're going to jump around a bit, looking back at some of the highlights from 2015. But there was something that unfolded in the spring, in the second quarter of the year, something that came to be known as Tomato Gate. And what was Tomato Gate?
Not a highlight, but a low light of 2015. The country music radio consultant Keith Hill, in an interview, explained why women musicians didn't work on country radio. And he famously said that women were, quote, not the lettuce in our salad. The lettuce is Luke Bryan and Blake Shelton, Keith Urban and artists like that. The tomatoes of our salad are the females. Now, this is a very sexist thing to say. It also is, in a sad way, the truth about country radio. Men have dominated country radio playlists for quite a while, and though it is getting better in some ways, they still do today. This caused an outrage among the women of Nashville, and ever since that happened, ever since he made that statement, Tomato Gate has been a rallying cry for women. There have been songs written about this subject. There have been networking organizations put together. Many individual women have protested. So it brought awareness to the fact that country has become this sort of like rock, you know, hard rock, a male-dominated genre, at least on the commercial radio side.
It reminds me, Anne, of, and forgive me for what feels like sort of a reductive comparison, but it reminds me of the things that I remember Sarah McLachlan saying in interviews and on MTV when she was starting Lilithfair, was that it's just like, yes, there are these rules in commercial radio that you can't play two women back to back. And why is that the case? Those are ridiculous rules. And it seems like in that case and in the case of what came to be known as Tomato Gate, it's not just that these people happen to make these points in public. It's that it's going on all the time. But there are flashpoints when somebody manages to say it either eloquently or in this case, really pretty bluntly.
I mean, he didn't, yes. And that's the thing about Keith Hill. He didn't just dismiss music by women and the role they play in country music. But I mean, he said, if you want to succeed, if a radio station wants to succeed, don't play too many songs by women.
Right. Let's not romanticize Keith Hill in this. He was not protesting. He was just, he was actually offering this as a reason why he wouldn't advise radio stations to play women, as you're saying, Robin. And the one hilarious thing that happened and wonderful thing that happened is that the young female country duo, Maddie and Tay, came back with a song written by two guys, but nonetheless sung by them, that responded to Tomato Gate. It was called Girl in a Country Song, and it went to number one on the country charts.
No country music was harmed in the making of this song. This is only a test.
Well, I wish I had some shoes on my two bare feet. And it's getting kind of cold in these painted on cut off jeans. I hate the way this bikini top chafes. Do I really have to wear it all day?
Yeah, baby.
I hear you over there on your tailgate whistling, saying, hey, girl, but you know I ain't.
So they react with a sense of humor that sort of disarms the entire thing.
I'd forgotten about all those stutter effects. The first, like, 7 seconds of that song could be mistaken for, like, early Eminem or something like that.
Oh, totally. You know, and though country radio remains way too much the realm of men, in my opinion, many women in the ensuing couple of years have made amazing work and amazing impact in country, including the three women who wrote the song Girl Crush, which won Song of the Year at the CMAs that very year, sung by Karen Fairchild of Little Big Town. And of course, Miranda Lambert, I don't know. The tomatoes are basically, I'm just having tomato sauce for my lunch. I don't know about y'all.
We'll talk more about the CMAs a little bit later in this podcast, but did this sort of outcry or protest, did it lead to, were there any changes? Did it lead to anything substantive?
Well, one thing I've seen in Nashville, where I live now, is a lot of organizing, women getting together to talk about this issue, to try to promote and support each other within the industry. There's a great organization called Change the Conversation. There's the CMT Next Women of Country, which is sort of this program that puts young women artists in front of bigger audiences. So it is happening. And of course, also in that place I like to call the third realm or the third way in between country and alternative or Americana or whatever you want to call it, people like Miranda Lambert and then later Margo Price really made a huge impact speaking their minds, making great albums.
Around the same time Tomato Gate was unfolding, in the spring of 2015, there were a number of high-profile nationwide protests by Black Lives Matter. Activists were also starting to get involved or more involved in the presidential campaigns. And there's been a lot of music both about that movement and part of that movement. But in 2015, there was a song by Kendrick Lamar from his To Pimp a Butterfly called All Right.
All's my life I has to fight. All's my life I hard times like, yeah. Bad trips like, yeah. Nazareth, I'm f***ed up, homie, you f***ed up. But if God got us, then we gon' be alright.
We gon' be alright. We gon' be alright. We gon' be alright. Do you hear me? Do you feel me? We gon' be alright. We gon' be alright. Huh? We gon' be alright. We gon' be alright. Do you hear me? Do you feel me? We gon' be alright.
Daoud, what role did this song, All Right, end up playing in Black Lives Matter?
It's sort of hard to say for certain, right? Because there's so much in it that seems, in retrospect, was just inevitable that the song and the moment would connect. And on the ground, I'm sure it wasn't at all the case. You know, Black Lives Matter is, I mean, it's an official network, albeit a loose one, but it's also, you know, you might call it a political position or a state of mind or a hashtag. It's kind of all of these things.
Yeah.
And so to think about a song like All Right, I mean, if you look at the video for that song, which is just gorgeous and haunting, this amazing black and white video, you know, Kendrick knew what he was doing. There are so many shots where it looks like he's flying, but the camera spends a lot of time just looking at his feet dangling in the bottom of the frame in a way that feels totally evocative of lynching. And obviously there's this really intense climax where he sort of acts out a police shooting, and then at the very end he sort of looks up at the camera and winks. And so that's the contradiction inherent in a song like this, and in the slogan, the whole idea of We Gonna Be All Right, that hook that I didn't realize was Pharrell for a long time, and then one day I was like, it's always Pharrell, it's true.
Degrees of Pharrell.
He's always there. But it's like, you know, what is that really there to say? It could be a message of hope, but it's also the kind of thing that you tell yourself when you feel hopeless and frustrated. And the whole thing of how it came to be associated with the movement seems to be, you know, the message of the song, and I think the thing that people were feeling in the streets in Ferguson and elsewhere is just that, like, it's bad right now. And there's no way to go on unless you tell yourself that it's going to be okay.
And I think the beautiful thing about All Right is that it captures the heart of African-American struggle from the beginning of this country. Because as you're saying, Daoud, the spirit of that struggle is resiliency. You know, the spirit of that struggle is not necessarily the joy of a complete freedom, but the resolute decision to continue on with every setback and embrace every small victory. I think this song invokes that exact spirit, and that's why it works so well.
Sure, yeah. You think of, you know, spirituals and work songs and things like that. And there's parts in this song that sound like a marching band is playing it. Like,
yes.
It goes to so many places. And, you know, and there's jazz horns. It goes to so many places. And it's a tour of history. It's a tour of black history.
Misusing your influence. Sometimes I did the same. Abusing my power full of resentment. Resentment that turned into a deep depression. Found myself screaming in the hotel room. I didn't want to self-destruct. The evils of Lucy was all around me. So I went running for answers.
Listening back to Pimp a Butterfly, it's a really depleting experience. There are gorgeous, enveloping moments, and then there's lots of hard stops. In this song and elsewhere, there are moments where he is acting out being awake at night in a hotel room and just, like, screaming to the heavens. So, yeah, there's an internal struggle being talked about there, too.
I actually read about this album and the Sufjan, Carrie and Lowell album together as examples of artists exploring their own solitude and what happens when you have to confront yourself. So yeah. So I definitely agree with that connection, Daoud.
Yeah.
We have to take a short break, but we will be right back.
Support for NPR Music's 10th anniversary and the following message come from iZotope, makers of Spire Studio, the portable multi-track recording system that lets you easily capture, mix, and edit professional quality songs wherever and whenever inspiration strikes. With built-in Wi-Fi, Spire Studio seamlessly connects to the Spire app, so you can ditch the cables to collaborate and share with bandmates and fans around town or around the world. Learn more at spire.live.
It's All Songs Considered. I'm Robin Hilton. I'm here with Dawood Tyler Amin from NPR Music, and Ann Powers is in Nashville. And let's listen to this. We're jumping ahead now to the fall of 2015. This is Chris Stapleton.
Throwing shadows in the dark, and the memories keep on turning to the rhythm of a broken heart.
I was thinking how after Tomato Gate, a male country singer, Chris Stapleton, ends up just completely dominating the CMAs that year, the Country Music Awards.
Yes, the solution to not enough women in country is better men in country. That's all right. I love Chris Stapleton. And let's just say Chris Stapleton and his wife, Morgan, are really a team. So I consider these wins a win for Morgan Stapleton as well.
Well, okay, so Chris Stapleton, this is from his record, Traveler. He ends up winning New Artist of the Year, Album of the Year, Male Vocalist of the Year. He performed at the CMAs with Justin Timberlake. What did it mean after everything that had happened at the end of the year? What did it mean for him to sweep the awards like this?
I mean, I made a joke of the fact that Chris Stapleton triumphed in a year that the dearth of women on country radio was on a lot of people's minds. But in fact, this does seem to be a way that country is working through its own issues with itself, or rather, I should say, the Nashville-based music industry is working through its own issues with itself, to turn toward a very traditional idea of authenticity in many ways. Chris Stapleton is a longtime Nashville fixture. He is a hit songwriter. He was long known as having one of the greatest voices in Nashville, sang background on tons of songs, played bluegrass, was in a country rock band. You know, he's a beloved guy here in Nashville, and a lovable guy, I must say, as well. His music was not successful on country radio. He did not have country radio hits, still doesn't. He's released two albums since Traveler, both top sellers, but he doesn't rely on country radio. He was showing a different way to be a country star, very heavily connected to touring, to streaming, to all of the new technologies that are taking pop into the 21st century. So he had this classic sound, this classic look. He's like a long-haired, bearded guy in a cowboy hat. And then his career works in kind of a future way. So he's the best of both. And I think that's one reason everyone in Nashville was so excited for him when he won all these awards.
Yeah, I was going to ask how his sweep of the awards was received.
Oh, joy. I mean, joy, I think, because the other main two people who were seen as challenging the country status quo, and they are also guys, Sturgill Simpson and Jason Isbell, uh-huh, stand much more outside the, you know, kind of the Nashville establishment than Stapleton does. I'm all for Chris's success, and everybody here is too, I think.
As we've said in just about every one of these episodes, we're only scratching the surface of everything that happened in each year, and that's certainly true of 2015. But there's one more thing before we wrap up this podcast, this episode, that I want to talk about that maybe musically the biggest story of the year.
Yeah, when you look at this, it's hard to remember anything else that happened that year.
And that's Hamilton.
Hamilton.
Rich folks love more than going downtown and slumming it with the poor. They pull up in their carriages and gawk at the students in the common just to watch them talk. Take Philip Schuyler, the man is loaded. Uh-oh, but little does he know that his daughters, Peggy, Angelica, Eliza, sneak into the city just to watch all the guys.
I don't know, Dad, how do you even begin to put into words the mania around Hamilton?
Hamilton is, the line about it when people first started to become aware of it was, this shouldn't work.
Right.
You know, for lots of reasons. I mean, it's David Diggs, who in the original cast played Thomas Jefferson and the Marquis de Lafayette, said that when he was approached about doing a reading for it and Lin-Manuel Miranda explained to him what the concept of the story was, he was like, that sounds like a really bad idea.
So, remind us why it worked so well. You saw it, right?
Yeah, at the very end of 2015, I had a friend who was selling a ticket. And, of course, it's tremendous. I only wish that I had not been listening to the cast album every day so I wasn't just, like, mouthing along the words and, you know, would allow myself to be a little bit surprised by it. But the irony here, right, is that this is a work of theater, which means that only a couple of people can see it at a time. You know, they did, you know, 8 shows a week. And yet it felt like a monoculture moment of the kind that's just astoundingly rare. Think about, you know, other records that were released that year. There's Carly Rae Jepsen's Emotion. 21 Pilots released, you know, Blurry Face, which is one of the hugest records of that year and the year following it. But, you know, we're at a moment where there are such giant divides in terms of what people are experiencing at any one time. And the joke I heard more than anything else in 2015 was, can you get me tickets to Hamilton?
Right.
That was the eternal catchphrase.
Right, yeah.
Well, as someone who failed to get tickets to Hamilton, my marriage almost ended because I couldn't get tickets to Hamilton.
Wow.
I'm still suffering under the fact that I couldn't get tickets to Hamilton. I have to say, while yes, it was a monocultural feeling moment, there are still a lot of people who haven't gotten to see it, and I feel that it was most monocultural in New York City. My friends who are parents of kids my daughter's age, my daughter's 13, their kids are Hamilton kids. You walk around Brooklyn and you see kids, like in the park, reciting Hamilton lyrics to each other, you know, acting out the musical. But I have to disagree just a little bit. I mean, and I know the soundtrack was very successful, but I think the monoculture, I think it's one of these cases where New York views itself as the world a little bit.
That's fair. But, I mean, we have to address the cast album because that's, you know, it's probably the reason why the phenomenon was allowed to spread in the way that it did. You know, it's a particular nature of the show that the entire story is in the songs. There's basically no spoken dialogue. So you can listen and you can follow the entire thing. Also, they got the roots to produce it. And there's a great interview that Lin-Manuel Miranda did with John Caramonica on the New York Times podcast, where he explained that a lot of time Broadway cast albums are done, they do the whole session in one day and they just have the cast sing live, you know, on top of the band, and that's it. And the way that they did this one was they took a couple of weeks and they mixed it so that instead of the vocals being all the way on top, it was more of like a 60-40 split.
Like a hip-hop record.
More like a hip-hop record. And if you listen, I mean, there, you know, there's all kinds of touches that somebody had a moment where they were like, this could theoretically rattle the trunk of a car, even though it's a show tune.
Well, it was great talking to both of you, Anne in Nashville.
Yes, excellent.
And Daoud, thanks so much for this.
Totally.
Daoud, if we were going to go out on a song from Hamilton, what would it be?
Well, I guess the one that shocked the most people at the time, just in terms of how they could pull it off, was, you know, something like Ten Dual Commandments.
Let's do it.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. It's the 10 Dual Commandments.
All right, thanks, everybody. It's All Songs Considered from NPR Music. I'm Robin Hilton.
Number one, the challenge demands satisfaction. If they apologize, no need for further action.
Number two,
if they don't, grab a friend, that's your second.
Your lieutenant, when there's reckoning to be reckoned.
Number three,
have your seconds meet face to face. Negotiate a peace
or negotiate a time and place.
This is commonplace, especially between recruits.
Most disputes die and no one shoots. Number four,
if they don't reach a peace, that's all right. Time to get some pistols and the doctor on site.
You pay them in advance, you treat them.